Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Republican field for governor grew last week with Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor filing her paperwork with the Secretary of State's office for her campaign committee. Actually, hers is the first official paperwork to be filed, I think. Attorney General Mike DeWine and Secretary of State John Husted have let it be known, however, that they are very interested in the job. We'll talk about that and more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning.
Also, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Glad to be here.
And Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. Welcome as always.
Good morning.
Let's see now. In a prepared statement, the first thing that Mary Taylor noted was that, quote, we are blessed to live in an amazing country where conservative reform is coming, end quote. So she raised that conservative flag right off the bat. Laura Bischoff, it kind of, you know, sets the tone.
Sure. I mean, it looks like it's going to be a three-way primary between Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, Secretary of State John Husted, and Attorney General Mike DeWine. And we all know that in primaries, you know, people tend to go to the right or to the left, depending on the party, to try to get the, you know, the party faithful, the base voters excited and get them on their side. So I think you'll see all three of them kind of move to the right and play that card. And we saw that back in, was it 2006, when Ken Blackwell and Jim Petro, Betty Montgomery was thinking about running at that time. She backed off and decided to run for attorney general again. Mm-hmm. But you saw Petro, who's kind of a moderate Republican, he kind of moved to the right as well.
Yeah, and now he's back true to form, campaigning, you know, dedicating pretty much the rest of his career to ending the death penalty.
The death penalty and wrongful convictions.
Right.
So I think we'll see, like I said, a three-way race. We'll see. It could be a really interesting primary.
It could be interesting.
Well, I would add a fourth name to that.
Okay.
In the mix, and that would be Congressman Jim Renacci from Northeast Ohio. I know he's expressed interest in running. Last week, he was in Columbus meeting with some business leaders here and reporters, and coming off sounding very, very gubernatorial in his answers to questions.
And conservative enough?
I think so. You know, he made an interesting comment last week. You know, repeal and replace has been the mantra around Obamacare. And he, you know, said, you know, essentially, well, you know, kind of like I forget the exact phrase he used. It was repeal and maybe revise or something like that. But he acknowledged the concerns that many people have about the pieces of the Affordable Care Act that they like and not, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You know, he is independently wealthy. He could, you know, easily throw his hat in the ring without having a $2.5 million war chest already built up.
Which is what Mike DeWine and John Husted each have, $2.5 million, give or take. Mary Taylor raised about $1 million, a little over $1 million for a PAC that she can't participate in anymore, right?
Right. I mean, soft money to a group called Onward Ohio. It was formed, I don't know, a couple years ago, I think, because, you know, she had been attached to the Kasich Taylor campaign committee. And so this Onward Ohio was sort of a placeholder, raised almost $1 million, but only from, I think, five or six different contributors.
Okay.
So now with the regular campaign committee that she has set up, they can just go the more traditional route. But again, raising money through the traditional route, you know, you face stricter campaign finance limits. I think the limits just got bumped up again. They're tied to inflation. So it's like $12,700 per person per cycle mm-hmm. for individual contributions. So it's harder to amass a lot of money in a short term.
From a few people.
Right.
It's impossible.
It's impossible to do it through your regular campaign
right.
committee.
And Mary Taylor, Kathy Kandisky, you know, she apparently, ostensibly, that PAC was to raise name recognition in Ohio. How's she done?
That's going to be, I think, her biggest challenge is her name recognition. I mean, she's been lieutenant governor for a number of years.
For 7 years, yeah.
And what we saw with the just recently with the race, I think Renacci has the same problem. I mean, I think name recognition, I would definitely say DeWine and Husted are favored in that department right now. But there's plenty of time. And one thing I'd say about Mary Taylor is she seems to now be hitching her wagon to the Trump folks. She kind of switched allegiance in the race for the Republican Party chair just recently.
Right.
And backed Timken, which should help her. I mean, raising money, help her with some, you know, support around the state. But it'll be interesting. I think she's got some ground to make up.
And Governor Kasich, who is not favored by the Republican Party, you know, leaders, I guess, is supporting her.
Right. I think that will help her. I think that, you know, I think that the Republicans are they were definitely there was a divide. There was the Matt Borges camp, which was, you know, Kasich supported him. And then Jane Timken ran against him for state party chair. She had the backing of Donald Trump and his team. And she was able to win the race. And so there was there's some thought that that. Showed that the governor is a lame duck and that there's he's got diminished clout in the state, but he's still the governor and he can still he's got huge name ID. And I think if he campaigns vigorously for her, that will help her, you know, certainly in the primary. And he's indicated he's going to support her.
Right.
You know, Jackie's talking about Jim Renacci. And I think there's some thought that maybe if he's going to run, that maybe Mary Taylor might step back and run for Congress because I think she lives in his district. Is that right?
I think so.
Hmm.
So, well, you know, we'll see.
Everything's in place still. Hard to believe. It's 2 years away, you know, year and a half.
And on the Democrat side, you know, it's right. difficult to figure out who's, you know, who they have from their farm team to step up. There's, you know, everybody keeps talking about Rich Cordray. Former attorney general. He's now the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is under fire by the Republicans. You know, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley is apparently thinking about it. I've heard Betty Sutton, former congresswoman from Akron. Mm-hmm. They have like a cast of thousands that are apparently
But they don't have anybody real obvious, though, with good name recognition. I think they're going to face a real challenge like they faced in the last couple of gubernatorial elections. They just have a real challenge getting somebody who's known throughout the state.
Right. I would say Rich Cordray probably fits the bill as well as anybody does, but he doesn't seem to be – he seems to be a reluctant possibility. For one thing, if he could keep his job, he'd keep his job. If they put the kibosh on it –
Well, and the downside for him is he's for the last couple of years he's been in this position in which he can't really participate in politics.
Right.
So he has been, although on the national scene and the consumer scene, he's certainly a key player. I think back in Ohio, people have maybe kind of forgotten about him. He hasn't really – he's not out at rallies. He's not at party dinners. He's not, you know, kind of working the back scenes.
But that could play in his favor. You know, that could play in his favor in terms of if people are looking for somebody, a change agent, an outsider like they always seem to be. You know, he could maybe fit that bill.
Huh. Yeah. And nobody's mentioned Hagan, Congressman Hagan. I'm sorry, Ryan.
It's the different Irish name.
Yes,
yeah, Tim Ryan from
the same part of the state.
You know,
from the Youngstown area. He's often
fail.
He's often you know just thought of as a good candidate. He's
but he's still totally not interested. So or not maybe.
I don't know. You know, it's always a risk because the congressional reelection cycle matches up with the governor's race, and so you know you can't run from safety. You can't go back to your other job if you fail.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I think he likes his current job
right.
pretty well. I mean, to give it up on a chance of winning the governorship, I don't know. That is a big risk to take.
In a state otherwise completely controlled by Republicans.
You know, Sherrod Brown was able to do that. He was a congressman and he had a pretty safe district and he took a gamble and ran for U.S. Senate and beat Mike DeWine. So. But it definitely takes a leap.
He's in for a race, another race against state treasurer.
Well, we'll see. I think, you know, Josh Mandel has already said he's going to run.
Right.
And he's taking aim at Sherrod Brown. It's yet to be determined whether or not he might face a primary from somebody like Pat Tiberi or, you know, some other candidate. But yeah, Mandel wants a rematch against Sherrod Brown, and there's a good chance he'll get that. Now he ran into some difficulty in recent recent days, Jackie and I have both reported on his use of $1.8 million on that TV ad that I think a lot of people in Central Ohio have seen. It's been running for several months, and it shows it stars Josh Mandel and Ohio State football coach Urban Meyer, and then a young woman with Down syndrome. And it's to promote a program. It's kind of like a 529 program, a savings account for families with kids with disabilities, so that they can sock away money invested to cover future expenses, maybe once
tax
the
free.
Right, tax mm-hmm. advantage. And Mandel was the first treasurer in the country to get the thing up and running. There's, I think, like 2,200 accounts have been opened. But the story that we wrote had to do with the decision to advertise this on TV advertising. I checked with the other states that have these programs set up, and I talked to a guy who is in the Illinois treasurer's office, and they run an alliance of 14 of the 16 states that have these stable accounts. And he said, to his knowledge, only North Carolina had run some TV ads and had since stopped. But the other states are doing more targeted marketing, you know, working with like Autism Speaks and Special Olympics and, more grassroots organizations to get the word out instead of having statewide advertising, which is on TV, which is pretty expensive.
And in some states, they ban officials from starring in these kind of ads.
Right. Illinois has a law that bans publicly paid advertising that uses the likeness of a statewide elected office holder. And there have been cases in Ohio where other elected office holders have used.
Oh, sure.
I mean, that's where you see John Husted saying, hey, it's time to apply for your absentee ballot.
Well, their websites are taxpayer funded and their faces are slapped all over the place on those things.
Sure.
So there's lots of stuff. And we were going to continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Also, Jackie Borchardt from Cleveland.com and Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. If you have questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com State House reporter Jackie Borchardt, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. The John Husted, Ohio Secretary of State John Husted, they put out a news release this morning saying that he has done an investigation and it's uncovered that non-citizens registered to vote and illegally cast ballots, but is quick to caution that it didn't come anywhere close to the 3 million that President Trump is saying illegally voted in the presidential election. So he's saying about 126 over the course of several years, right, Jackie Borchardt?
Right. So a couple years ago, his office did a similar survey. And what they did is they took the voter registration data and matched it against BMV records, state BMV records, and found that in a certain number of instances since 2013, a total of 821 instances, that result pinged back as the person was a non-citizen, according to the BMV. So this is someone who is here, on a work visa or is able to get a driver's license, for example, where it's known that they are a non-citizen and then also registered to vote. Of those, 126 have cast ballots, and that's since 2013. So broken down, that's 17 in 2013 review, 27 in the 2015 review, and 82 in the 2017 review. And last time, when Secretary Husted released this information, he made it very clear that, you ask, why, how can this happen or why does it happen? And the main reason that that this actually occurs is that people who hope to become citizens think that this will improve their chances to become a citizen or a permanent resident of the U.S.
By showing some kind of civic responsibility?
Right. Or that it's required for that. If I think the thought line of thought is, you know, I need to do this as part of, you know, becoming a citizen. And what they did last time and what they're also doing this time is sending a letter to those people who registered, pointing out the error and asking them to remove their registration. And then the cases where they did vote are being forwarded to prosecutors.
So they're not rounding them up or anything?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
Well, I mean, being registered, and this is a big point, I think, that needs to be made over and over again in light of the discussion nationally about voter fraud and having, you know, dead people on the voter rolls or people registered in multiple states. That doesn't necessarily mean that fraud occurred. I mean, they shouldn't, you know, these non-citizens should not have registered to vote, but for most of them, it was a confusion thing. And it's not fraud if they don't actually go and cast a ballot.
And also keep in mind that there were 5.6 million ballots cast in 2016.
Alone.
And 82 of them were from people who were not non-citizens who should not have cast ballots. So it's a very, very small percentage. And Houston's office said that of the 126 cases of non-citizens casting ballots since 2013, none of them have been in elections where it was decided by one vote. So luckily it hasn't, apparently it has not changed out the outcome of any issues or races. It's good that they are, you know, going through and auditing the records and finding it out and correcting the problems and referring it to prosecutors. Mm-hmm. But it is not a massive voter fraud. There's no evidence of massive voter fraud.
John Husted's been one of those Secretary of States, Kathy Kandiski, that's always come out when President Trump has alleged voter fraud on the scale of some 3 million votes in the presidential election. He's always come right out and said that just probably is not true. That can't
be
true.
I mean, he and Secretary of States in other states have been really strong on this point and taken, you know, offense to the point that Trump has made that there's widespread voter fraud when, in fact, they're not seeing it in their states.
In populous states like Ohio,
yeah. I mean, Ohio's election wasn't particularly close in the presidential race, so these 120, well, it wasn't even 120 this year. But
82.
82 didn't make a difference. But still, you can see how, you know, it's an issue and it needs to be corrected. I think that Husted, like his colleagues in other states, don't want to see the problem overblown because it undermines people's faith in the electoral process, and that's a bad thing for us.
Right. And Husted's office is using this review, as he did the last one, to push the federal government to allow Ohio officials to check those records against Social Security numbers that are kept at the federal level. Right now, that check is done just with the BMV. And in Ohio, you can also register to vote using the last four digits of your Social Security number, which they're unable to check against federal records.
Kathy Kandiski, you. Let's turn to the Healthcare Affordable Care Act right now. Governor Kasich met with President Trump on Friday and was again at the White House on Saturday, ostensibly to talk about reported plans to put the kibosh on Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act. Governor Kasich likes the expansion. The Trump administration does not appear to share that sentiment, along with lots of Republicans in Congress. What do we know about what he talked about at this point?
Well, Governor Kasich's trying to protect the 700,000 folks who've come on to Medicaid in Ohio under the expansion. So, you know, the governor doesn't want to see those folks get thrown out off the rolls and lose their health care. And likewise, the governor doesn't know where Ohio would come up with the money to pay for it themselves if the federal funds were withdrawn at this point. So he's not the only Republican governor. There were several Republican governors that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. And now I would imagine Kasich, along with many of them, are urging the president and Congress to preserve Medicaid expansion so they can continue that. Ohio thinks they have some ideas on running the Medicaid program as well to make it more cost effective. Things like managed care, payment reform, things they've done here in Ohio in the last few years that have really kind of led the way across in the nation with Medicaid. And I think they're trying to pitch those ideas as well to Congress and also to the NGA. The National Governors Association is expected to rally around a proposal on the ACA and how it's going to impact states. This is a big deal for states. There's a lot of money that they get from the feds for Medicaid, not just expansion under the ACA, but Medicaid in general. So they want to preserve those funds.
But for regular Medicaid, the match is what, like
65%.
65% is federally funded.
It's federally funded. Under Medicaid expansion by 2020, the feds will be paying 90% and the states will be paying 10%. So Ohio, if it goes to a regular match, it would be 65%. If that's maintained, we don't know that would be maintained. It may be lowered.
Right. And he's said that Ohio can't afford that.
No. Ohio's in a tight budget right now. It's hard to imagine where they come up with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to support
that. In perpetuity, yeah.
And it's important to the state because Medicaid expansion has allowed the state to treat a lot of folks with addiction. It's about a third. When you ask the governor how much Ohio has spent for addiction services under this opiate crisis, he'll tell you about $1 billion. About a third of that or more is Medicaid expansion that has allowed people who didn't have health insurance to get it covered and get treated for their addiction. So it's a big deal in Ohio.
Yeah, and I think the folks who signed up under Medicaid expansion, that there's something like 70% have either a mental health issue or a drug abuse, drug addiction issue. So, you know, huge need.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There was a report that just came out that the state did showing how Medicaid expansion has helped people maintain employment. You know, there's a lot of good things about it. Get addiction services for addiction or mental health needs that they weren't getting. There's people who have been diagnosed with cancer since getting health coverage that now know they have diabetes, high blood pressure, other things that are a lot easier to control and getting treatment for those things. So, it's, you know, the governor has been a real strong supporter of expansion, and he's going to try and get Congress and the Trump administration to back him on that. We'll see how he does. Hmm.
But already, like U.S. Representative Jim Jordan of Urbana, he's kind of I don't know if he's a leader or he's definitely a member of the Freedom Caucus, which is the very conservative wing in the U.S. House, has, you know, pushed back and said, look, voters did not vote for us to repeal all of Obamacare except Medicaid expansion. I mean, they want to. His group wants to repeal it entirely and replace it with probably something that's much more scaled back.
Or nothing.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it was interesting because John Boehner last week said, former Speaker of the U.S. House said, you know, the Republicans never agree on health care and that this is just happy talk.
This is tough politically. I mean, politically, who wants to throw people off health insurance? Who wants to throw the person who's getting addiction, mental health services off the program? I mean, this is tough to do. This is going to be you see all
who
these
wants
town
to
halls.
Throw the kid off with pre-existing condition.
Right. Who wants to make it harder for these people to get coverage? I mean, you see these town halls that are going on all over the country right now where people are speaking out. The country's pretty divided on this issue. I mean, a lot of people are unhappy with parts of the ACA, but there's a lot of parts they want to keep. So how do you do that? How do you please everybody? I mean, this is a real tough situation for the Republicans that have pledged to repeal the ACA and replace it with what? It's going to be hard. They're going to create losers.
Well, and the other thing is any replacement is every replacement that's been suggested. You know, we haven't seen a plan that Republicans have consensus around, but every proposal that's been suggested so far would result in some people losing coverage. You're not going to have the same level of coverage that you have now, or, you know, same level of people being covered as you have now. And as we're seeing at these town halls where people have concerns, some of them are, you know, they are really concerned about the price. They're glad that they were able to purchase coverage, but you know, it's very costly for them. Mm-hmm. And others are, you know, they're getting subsidies through the program, and the price. They said, you know, how are the Republicans going to be able to beat that with whatever they come up with? Odds are they won't. So, you know, that's part of that political thing is how do you come up with something that doesn't result in people losing their insurance or not being able to afford it.
It seems like they'll replace it with something much, much better. Promise has kind of gone by the wayside, that the White House is acknowledging that they're not going to be able to do that. that they're not going to have much, much better coverage for people.
I don't think they're acknowledging anything, okay. but they're not responding to those kind of questions. You know, I mean, when pressed on things like, can you guarantee people aren't going to, no one's going to lose coverage? Well, nobody can answer that question. They're not willing to answer. These are tough questions that maybe by their silence, you know, we have the answer.
I don't know that they have the answer, though, because they don't have the plan. They don't have the replacement plan. So
it's true.
Yeah. The Washington Post just reported, you know, and it's nothing new, but that Republican lawmakers are struggling to replace it. The ones who are working on it aren't getting much guidance from the White House.
Well, they don't have a plan yet.
Right.
And they can't agree on a plan. And, you know, it took the Democrats, what, 15 months to pull together?
Well, 22 before any of it started going into effect.
Right.
Yeah, it's complicated. And they said even at the time, I remember, that this needs to be tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. But no tweaking occurred because
there is no political will for that either.
Right.
You know, a lot of people have complained that that Obamacare didn't do anything to curb health care costs. And to a large extent, that's true. People talk about prescription drug costs and such. But you don't hear people talking about fixing those problems either. So it's interesting. It's a real pickle for Republicans. It's going to be interesting to see what they're able to come up with. Or if Boehner's prediction that they're not going to do anything, which is becoming more likely from my perspective, if that holds true.
You know, anyways, getting back to the important stuff, I'm kidding. There was a question about who asked who to the White House. And, you know, politics reared its ugly head once again. Obviously, John Kasich was the ultimate holdout. You know, the one he wouldn't go to the Republican convention last summer in his very own city, you know, his own backyard in Cleveland, Ohio. Why was that an issue, and was that ever resolved, Laura Bischoff?
I don't think it was resolved. I think both sides was like, no, he asked me to the prom. He asked me to the prom.
Right.
It was kind of like, I don't know. It seemed kind of silly.
Can you just show up at the White House without an invitation, though? I mean, how does that work? I mean, I wouldn't he have had to have been invited?
I can't imagine he can demand
an audience
with the president
yeah.
and get it under this, you know,
right.
given their history. So,
It's unusual, though, given the you know, Trump's usually not kind to his former enemies. And
well, Kasich it was a Republican Governors Association meeting in Washington.
Right, and the National Governors Association meeting as
and
well.
And the NGA.
He's
going to
be
okay.
there anyway.
Yeah. So they probably put together a platoon, and he was just part of that group.
He did have President Trump did have a private meeting ahead of those two events with a group of governors from states that had expanded Medicaid and some that hadn't. And afterward, Governor Kasich, you know, emphasized the health care discussions that they had. But he also said that they talked about a couple other things. He stressed the importance of talking as one voice from the White House and you know, some. But he really focused on the health care stuff. But he did drop a few other things where it seemed like maybe he, you know, was trying to give President Trump some words of advice.
Like
and
what?
He did seem to try and bury the hatchet, I thought, when he said they asked him about his support for Trump, and he said, you know, when you're on the plane, you got to root for the pilot.
Right.
It's kind of a backhanded compliment, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah.
But he also did, you know, release a statement afterwards saying that, you know, I think that, you know, I believe in being constructive. I think constructive was the word he used, and that doesn't always mean being 100% positive. And that if there are things you know, that I disagree with, I'm going to speak up about. And that's not a change in what he's been saying all along.
But for the sake of Ohio, I think that the governor needs to, you know, reach out to Washington and try to get policies that will help the state, for example, on Medicaid expansion. He's advocating for what he thinks is right for Ohio.
And he's got a big problem if they don't. I mean, this blows a huge hole in his budget proposal. So there's a lot at stake.
You had a story in the paper on Sunday, Kathy Kandisky, about the Dispatch is starting a series going around the state talking about what people, you know, that voted for Trump care about and how they feel about him now and what attracted them to him. How much of the healthcare issue is a part of that from your reporting?
Not as much. I mean, it comes up, but what really comes up, at least with the person I spoke with in Hebron, Ohio, was security and the international safety, the wall, the immigration ban, those kind of things. Things to keep us safe from folks overseas that would do us harm.
So is it possible that maybe they could replace it with something that maybe people don't care that much about that? Or is there a big split out there?
I think there's a split. I think, you know, ahead of the election, I talked with a lot of voters who, you know, strongly believed in repeal and replace, that Obamacare was broken and, you know, it can't be fixed. It just needs to be thrown out. And then talk to other voters who, for them, that was not their issue. They were, like Kathy said, more concerned about national security or jobs. And, you know, many of them were receiving insurance through the exchange, or you know, their family members were able to get coverage, and so they didn't want that part to go away. So you've kind of seen, you know, and that's where I question some of these congressmen saying that we were elected, you know, because of to repeal and replace Obamacare. I think there is a split, and I think you're seeing that evidence in some of these town hall meetings from some of the vocal opposition to repeal and replace, even from some Republicans.
And it really comes down to your own personal situation. I mean, if you have health care, you're not worried about this issue. If you are someone, I mean, the folks I hear from, the everyday reader folks, not the political types, mm-hmm. are parents who have medically fragile children, disabled kids, are people that have pre-existing conditions that haven't been able to get insurance, hadn't been able to get insurance before, and now they can. Those are kind of the everyday folks I hear from. So it kind of depends on your situation. A lot of people in Ohio are low-wage workers, and they can't, even if their companies offer health care, they can't afford to purchase it. So they're kind of in a jam, and I hear from a lot of those people as well. So I think this issue really comes down to your own personal experience, whether you've got health care or not. And I'd point out, the woman in Hebron I spoke to is 67 years old and on Medicare and was complaining about some of the copays she was paying on the prescription drug costs and hoping they would deal with that.
Hmm.
It's really kind of personal, I think, for folks.
I think she was also listed as a retired ODOT worker, right?
Correct.
So she probably also has access to purchasing mm-hmm. insurance
supplemental
through the pension
right.
system.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. We will continue our conversation. This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. That's Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable, and still with us, Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Jackie Borchardt, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Laura Bischoff, you wrote last week that new rules have been proposed for medical marijuana. Now it's been about a year and a half.
Right.
A main thrust is to avoid making medical marijuana look appealing to children.
Right. So they're not going to have any cartoon characters allowed for marketing. I think that it was kind of oddly worded, but something about, like, you can't have popular candy approximations. You can't have
like
fruit
gummy
shapes.
Gummy things. And,
yeah. So, and then also they want to put a ban on vaping by patients under 18. You know, the law says that patients won't be allowed to smoke it, but will be allowed to vaporize it, vaping, but not, I guess, not for under 18.
What are their concerns? Is this been a problem elsewhere?
I don't know. You know, they've done a lot of kind of benchmarking to see how it's worked out in other states. For example, they're trying to define what constitutes a 90-day supply based on the THC content of the plant product or the transdermal patch or the edibles or the oils, et cetera. And I think it looks like Ohio is kind of going on a more on the conservative end of what might constitute a 90-day supply. It's interesting because they keep rolling out all these different batches of rules, like you know, testing labs, cultivators, patients and caregivers, et cetera. And they have layers of approval. They have the public comment section or window, and then it has to go through the Common Sense Initiative to make it's another layer. And then they have to go to
that's the Mary Taylor.
The
layer.
Mary Taylor, yeah. And then they have to do a JCAR, the Joint Committee on Agency Rule Review.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
And all, so this stuff all it so it has all these different layers it has to go through. But I think the target is next September to have the rules all approved and ready to go.
This coming September.
September, right.
2017, which means that you could actually prescribe medical marijuana.
Well, they don't use the word prescribe.
That's
because
right.
It's not approved by the FDA. Medical marijuana is still considered a controlled or is still considered a banned substance, a controlled
Schedule
substance.
One.
Right. Right. It was interesting that the Trump administration.
Right up there with heroin.
Right.
Yeah.
And cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting the Trump administration signaled that they're not going to mess with states that have medical marijuana legalization programs, but that those that have recreational, which I think is there's 8 states now. It's California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon.
The usual suspects. Maryland?
D.C.
D.C.
Yeah, okay, D.C.
Anyway, there was an indication from the Justice Department that maybe they'd, may have some issues.
With recreational.
Right, right. But Ohio's medical marijuana program, they're, you know, they have kind of a three-headed regulatory scheme where Department of Commerce, Pharmacy Board, and I'm blanking on the third one.
Medical Board.
Medical
Board. Yeah, State Medical Board are, you know, regulating the docs, the patients, and the business of doing this.
And they don't say prescribe. What is the word they use again?
Recommend.
Recommend.
Recommend. It's like getting a doctor's note.
Yeah. Yeah. Johnny was sick
stay home.
From school.
Just,
on
I've been out in Colorado a couple times in California, and the biggest concern I hear from people out in those states is that the drugs end up in the hands of children. So I think some of the things that Laura mentioned, like not making them like gummy bears and things like that,
mm-hmm.
is to address that. But that's the one kind of fail that people have repeatedly mentioned to me in states that have it, is how do you keep it away from kids?
There was also some concern. I went out to Seattle and did some reporting on how it's worked out there. And they had I think they were one of the first states in the nation to do medical marijuana. And there was a lot of concern that it was really a little bit of a joke in terms of, you know, you go to Dr. Feelgood and you say, oh, I got a bum knee. And they say, oh, well, you need medical marijuana and pay some cash. And next thing you know, you got your doctor recommendation. And I think that Ohio is trying to make sure that that doesn't happen here, that it's not just a, you know, a.
Yeah. I think it's hard once you have it. I think it's hard to regulate. Who's going to check out what all those doctors are recommending? Unless they're all coming from the same doctor.
Well, the doctors will have to register with the state, and then the doctor will send the patient registration form to the state to get their patient ID. So the state will know, you know, how many doctors are registering patients, who they're registering for what conditions. So, you know, if you end up with two doctors that are registering half the patients in the state, that, you know, might raise a red flag with the medical board. But, I mean, that's all going to be recorded by the state, and patients will have an ID card that they will have to present at the dispensary to purchase, to even get into the door.
Really?
To buy.
Wow, talk about red tape.
Yep.
That
and that Buddy, the responsible Ohio Buddy, yeah. the marijuana mascot, I don't think that will fly under the new rules.
Definitely
not.
It doesn't
sound like a good idea to have a mascot.
think so either.
but that is a concern. Is, you know, as they're rolling this out piecemeal, and you have three agencies looking at, each one of them is focusing on, you know, their area that they're supposed to focus on, and they're you know, coming up with the application process for these licenses and all the different costs and fees. A growing concern among advocates and people who are looking at this critically is, you know, how much is this going to cost? And those costs obviously are going to get handed down to the patient. Is it mm-hmm. going to be really expensive? Because you don't want to have a program where, you know, buying marijuana at the dispensary the legal way is too big of a problem, where you could just go down the street and buy it illegally.
Right.
For much less hassle and cost.
How much thought are they putting into the different kinds of marijuana that are out there, the different kinds? I mean, are they talking about that and the grades and all that kind of stuff?
You mean like the strains?
Yeah,
because how much?
Read about how different strains treat different things better than others. And
I mean, they're not limiting that. What they rolled out last week, which was how they calculate a 90-day supply, which the state law requires. That's how they decided to measure things, is in how much a patient could possess and for a 90-day period. And what they rolled out last week is they made a differentiation between kind of your, you know, marijuana plant material that has less than 23% of THC, which is an active compound that creates a psychoactive effect. That's what gets you high. And marijuana that's above that. And the state law actually caps it at 35. And most, from what I've read in most strains are not above that 23%, but they did. What they're trying to recognize is that, and they're trying to limit that possession amount based on the THC content, which is something new. No other state has done that across the board. And so I think that'll probably change as people look at that, because they basically kind of made a best estimate based on data that they reviewed of what that might be. But I think that still has a long way to go. It's a fairly new idea. Ohio's trying to be in front on that.
Boy, Jackie's really in the weeds on this.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Wow.
Okay. So what's happening at the State House now? What are you guys going to be looking at this week?
Well, there's always the budget, the transportation budget. And, you know...
There's always the budget.
There's always the budget. Thank goodness for Jim Siegel. He can go to all the budget hearings.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, the legislature just seems like they're constantly coming up with interesting bills. I think the Pastor Protection Act.
It's up for a vote.
Yeah, it might be coming up for a vote tomorrow. On the full House.
Okay.
I believe.
It's got a committee vote tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay.
And that would, you know, really spell it out that pastors and clergy are not required to perform same-sex marriages if it goes against their beliefs.
And they're already not required.
They're already not required. The governor indicated that he would sign it as long as it wasn't far-reaching, similar to Indiana or North Carolina, where, you know, those bills caused a big uproar in those states, and I think that I think the governor wants to avoid having that flare up in Ohio.
I think there's a abortion rights protest that's going to rally, depending on your perspective. It's going to happen on Wednesday. There's a number of abortion bills that have been introduced in the legislature that to further restrict abortions in Ohio. So there's some pushback on that, although I think that several of these bills will end up moving through.
Despite those protests.
Correct.
Okay. What about you, Jackie Borchardt?
I'm watching all those things that they mentioned. They really did just go down my list. But, yeah, I think, you know, with the governor's budget, the House has been reviewing it for the last couple of weeks.
Right.
And now is when we're going to start to, you know, this week, next week, we're going to start to see some more things change on that front. We saw last week the changes in the transportation budget, and that'll then head over to the Senate after this week. So I think, I mean, they are keeping busy over there. To anybody who complains that they don't work hard enough, I think they're.
But are they doing anything?
blowing that away right now.
What are they getting accomplished? I think you'll see stuff on the education budget. I mean, that's one of the more controversial aspects of the state budget is education funding. Several districts would lose money under the governor's proposal. That's going to be tough for some of the representatives to swallow. You know, they've got their constituencies complaining about that. So I expect we'll see some changes on the governor's school funding plan.
I'm working on stuff that I'm not going to start talking about on the radio because, I, you know, it's a secret until we actually publish it.
How are the districts responding now? I mean, are they starting to get pretty granular about this? Is it clear what will happen with the budget when it comes to the districts? Or is it still?
Well, they've had spreadsheets that show the districts, and I wish I could remember the number of districts that are going to lose funding under the governor's plan. But basically, those with declining school populations. In past budgets, the state has always guaranteed no district would lose money, even if, you know, school funding is based on how many kids you have. So if you have your enrollment is a certain rate, that's what your payment is based. So if you lose kids, you get less money. Well, under the previous budgets, they've always held them harmless. That's not going to be the case anymore. So some of the districts, none in Central Ohio, and I'm trying to think which districts they are that are losing money, mostly rural districts, I would imagine. That struggle to raise money locally.
Right.
So it's going to be real tough for them.
Well, and
they're seeing a lot of pushback on it.
I mean, in the last budget, the education numbers kind of shook out the same way where, you know, the guarantee, not all House, the House basically put that guarantee back in and said that, you know, we're going to make sure that no school district loses money again. I mean, it's really unpopular to go home to your district and face school officials that are losing money.
Sorry, we had to cut you.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's districts that have increasing enrollment, like the Olentangy schools is a good example in our area, that get capped on how much additional funding they can get. And the governor's trying to lift that cap a little bit to have some growth in those districts. Problem gets back to the whole same old political problem these guys deal with on everything is you create winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
So unless there's more money to put into the system, which evidently there is not, you know, they're just kind of reshuffling the deck.
There's also an interesting case coming up before the Ohio Supreme Court on the right for authorities to search kids' backpacks.
Right.
This case originated out of Whetstone High School, I believe, and I think it was a school security guard or somebody who they had reason to check this kid's backpack and found a gun in possession, and the lower courts ruled that it was an illegal search. And the overarching question in this is what rights to privacy and against search and seizure do students have on at school property?
And that's going before the Ohio Supreme Court,
right? And Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien is arguing that there shouldn't be these extra protections or standard protections. So
seems like schools, just like shopping malls and businesses, should be able to post a sign that says we're entitled to search your bag at any time.
But kids have to go to school. They don't have to go to the mall.
Is that the point? Yeah.
Although culture,
I guess that's the argument.
Norms might suggest differently. You're absolutely right. Laura Bischoff, thank you for that insight today.
That's interesting.
You're welcome.
Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, AllSides interns Sarah Stacey, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.